Hello, and welcome to Bardcast, the Shakespeare podcast. I'm Carson.
And I'm Jeff.
And today's episode is about Falstaff. Falstaff is a Shakespearean character that appears in four different plays.
Sir John Falstaff.
Shakespeare wrote the character as a historical event.
Kind of. I mean, he's like very much not his historical self.
Yeah, in the past, we've referred to Holinshed's histories of England.
And we'll be referring to them again in the future.
Yeah, and Holinshed is basically an English historian. And when Shakespeare read these histories, he found a character called Sir John Oldcastle.
Yeah.
And this is the character that Falstaff originally was. As far as we can tell, originally his name in the play was Oldcastle.
Mm-hmm.
We can tell this for several reasons. One, every time that someone is speaking in a poetic meter and they say Falstaff, it's out of meter. It should be a three-syllable word, like Oldcastle, but instead it's a two-syllable word of Falstaff. So that's very consistent, and so that's a good indicator. Also, someone refers to him as a knight of the castle, like old castle, of the castle, same sort of, just a pun.
It's basically just a reference to that we used to have this name, but we don't anymore.
Yeah.
A little in-joke for Shakespeare.
So, some people that descended from Oldcastle basically insisted that he not be that character.
Effectively, they threatened to sue for defamation, because Falstaff is such a horrible person.
Yeah, he's quite embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
It's even been thought that they perform it with Oldcastle as the name, and they only change it for the publication.
That's mostly nonsense, I think.
Yeah, it's a possibility, but there's no reason
to think so.
Yeah, it's just a little theory that people have.
A little stupid theory, in my opinion.
So the name Falstaff probably comes from, again, Holinshed's histories, where there is a Sir John Falstaff.
That's Falstaff with S-T-O-F-F.
Instead of F-A-L-S-T-A-F-F.
Exactly.
Like Falstaff.
Yep.
We're going to look at Falstaff's life, his life story.
This is the life story of Falstaff in the Henriade, not in the Merry-Wives of Windsor.
Right, we'll get to that in a moment. So, Falstaff was apparently a soldier in his early life, because he became a knight.
Yeah.
And we don't really get a feeling for what he did in his early life. In Henry IV, Part 2, they talk about how he was this kind of a college frat kid where he would drink and hang out with ladies and stuff like that 55 years ago.
Yeah, so he's at least in his 70s.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way he could have been that sort of character earlier than 15. So he's at least 70 years old when he's running around
with
doing all his shenanigans.
Hal, yeah.
In Henry IV, Part 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm. And the only indication we have of this is the one other old character from that time, Robert Shallow, who is a college buddy of his.
Right. And just a little note on age in Shakespeare's time. You probably know that life expectancy was much shorter back then.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean that people aged faster. It just means that people would die from disease or something like that. It doesn't actually mean that when he's 70, he's the equivalent of our 120 or something like that.
Right. It just means he's 70 and
he's lucky.
Yeah.
Because he managed to survive that long. Especially despite being ridiculously obese and drinking all the time.
Well, part of the thing is that he's great at scamming people.
Yeah, but, I mean, that doesn't... You can't scam death out
of... Oh, can't you?
Liver failure.
Can't you?
No. We first meet him in Henry IV, Part 1.
Yes.
When Hal and Falstaff are first talking, he claims that he, Falstaff, was originally a person who hung around in court and tried to gain favor from people.
A courtier, basically a lickspittle or suck-up.
Yeah, so he would just hang around with nobles and say, hey, you're pretty great, could you give me some money? And it seems like he kind of attached himself to the prince as kind of the ultimate lickspittle follower. Although he blames the prince for becoming a criminal, which is what he is in Henry IV.
Yes.
You sort of get the feeling that he's sort of dragged the prince down to this.
Not against the prince's wishes in any way.
Yeah, instead of the other way around. You definitely get the feeling that Falstaff has always been immoral, and he's involving Hal in his robberies.
Well, now that he doesn't have to be a courtier anymore, he can do whatever he wants, because he's got someone on his side that's important.
Right. Yeah, he's kind of latched on to Hal as protection.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of Henry IV, Part 1, he obviously has his famous robbery at Gad's Hill, where he's embarrassed because he's robbed by Hal.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes from being a robber to being a knight leading a army
against the rebellion.
He fights against the rebellion.
Fights from a certain point of view in that he mostly hides and gets his men killed.
Right, he drafts a bunch of people and tries to draft other people who bribe him into not joining the army, and then he leads his people to die so he doesn't have to pay them.
And gets to keep the money for them, yeah.
Yeah.
He's kind of a dick.
In Henry IV Part 2, he mentions, in fact, that they have people on the roster that do not even exist, and he's just collecting their pay as well. So it's really quite shameful in terms of being a soldier.
Yep.
And in Henry IV Part 2, this is really the play where you see the most of Falstaff in his element. He is carousing with people of his own class, and
the prince doesn't show up as often with him, so he isn't, like, showing off for the prince at all.
Yeah, he's doing all his punning and his shenanigans.
Monologuing for hours.
Yeah, and he's got some sort of a connection to Doll Tearsheet, which we've mentioned in the previous episode. She's a prostitute, but they seem to genuinely like each other in addition to that. And he does this entire drafting of soldiers thing where we see him being bribed to not recruit people.
He basically is abuses his position to get out of any form of punishment for crimes he commits.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. He's just a bad person.
Well, we're going to get to that later.
Yeah.
So at the end of Henry IV Part 2, a dancer shows up and talks about the thanks for watching the play. We're going to have a new one with Henry V and the invasion of France, and Falstaff will be there to make fun of everything, as is his way. But in Henry V, he's not there.
Yep.
Only the people that were around him, like Mistress Quickly, Pistol, and Doll Tearsheet are there.
And Hal.
Yeah. And so instead of seeing him, we get to hear someone talk about his death.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really a poetic description of this scene. Like, it's a really impassioned and well-written speech. But he doesn't get to do anything.
No, he's dead, and, well, the characters briefly grieve and then get over it.
Yeah, and there are theories about this. Like, maybe Shakespeare thought it was inappropriate to have such a lighthearted goofball in a more serious play.
Or maybe he just didn't fit in quite well enough.
Yeah, and maybe he kept on stealing scenes to the point where he just cut him out entirely. I mean, that's certainly the case in Part 2. I mean, Henry IV Part 2 became Falstaff's play.
Really annoyingly, too.
Okay, so after Henry V, we find Falstaff in The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Yep.
So we've gone from history to comedy, and this is a really bizarre transition, because it's completely out of continuity. We don't see Falstaff dealing with any of the issues he dealt with in the other plays.
Though some of the same characters are still around, like Pistol and Bardolph.
Yeah.
And Mistress Quickly.
And this is the only one of Shakespeare's plays that has nothing to do with nobility. It's all the common people goofing around. It's all sort of like home life. Someone watching the play as just a commoner would have complete understanding of everything was going on at their own level. There's an urban legend that was begun 100 years after Shakespeare's death that says that Elizabeth I personally asked Shakespeare to write a play with Falstaff falling in love.
Mm-hmm. Because she really liked the character of Falstaff.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious what my position is. I think it's an invention.
I think it's possible, but there's no evidence either way, so it doesn't matter.
Right. I mean, the person who wrote it, this legend down, was trying to actively promote his performance of the play, Merry Wives of Windsor. So I think that he has an obvious incentive to just make this up.
Really? I don't get what that would be.
I mean, he's just trying to associate this legend with the play that he's trying to put on. And just because we don't have any better data doesn't mean that we should accept bad data.
Mm-hmm. But it's no reason to completely discount it. It is possible.
Yeah,
so.
Sure. I mean, it does seem very odd to have Falstaff in this play, so maybe it is.
Either way, Merry Wives of Windsor is set 200 years later.
Yeah.
Basically, it's set in
It's basically in Shakespeare's time.
Yeah, and the characters, he has the same name, he has a similar personality, though not identical. He's probably younger, too.
The question at hand, is this character Falstaff?
I would say just consider him like a descendant of Falstaff or something.
Oh, that's an interesting solution. Name. Sort of people with the same name associate together throughout the generations.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, let's just look at the arguments. Anybody could see these characters and say, okay, that's Falstaff.
Well, he's the fat one, so he must be Falstaff.
Yeah, that's Justice Shallow. I mean, all of these characters are around again.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously he is Falstaff, because he's hanging out with the same people, but except the prince isn't there. And he's doing basically the same thing, and he's a big fat knight who's trying to trick people.
Yep.
But on the other hand, every single person who studies and writes about Shakespeare has said, no, he is not Falstaff. I've never seen a person who says it's the same character.
Well, it's not the same character, because there's just no continuity between the two.
Right.
Like, there's no in-story connection between the two, other than their name.
Yeah. And there's some similarities with the character, but
yeah.
He doesn't act in the same way. He's kind of a doofus in Merry Wives of Windsor.
To be fair, he's kind of a cunning doofus in Henry IV.
That's true.
Like, he still loses better, more often than he wins.
Right, but he never takes things lying down. And in
right, he always bounces back and says, oh, but this is where I'll go now.
Mm-hmm. And in this, it just kind of... He just kind of is an element of the plot where he just gets fooled and tricked and is just kind of pathetic, really, without his brilliant wit that justifies his character in the other plays. I think that he's probably originally just a character named something else.
Falstaff was so popular.
And the popularity demanded that he be in the play.
Though I've never personally understood the popularity of Falstaff as a whole anyway.
Well, we're going to get to that in a little bit. Falstaff as a character.
Yep.
We're not going to say, is he a good person or a bad person?
We're just going to say, or at least I'm going to say, he is a bad person.
Right. I think that if you looked at him in an ethical sense, anyone would have to conclude that he was a bad person.
Right.
He's a robber. You don't really get the sense that he's a murderer, but that's because he's too much of a coward.
Right.
Instead of having ethics.
I wouldn't even say he's immoral, necessarily, just completely amoral.
Right. He doesn't care about rules of society.
And he doesn't care about anyone but number one.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to look at what makes him a good character. Nobody says that Macbeth is a good person.
Well, some people do. Like, or he was a good person before. Well, let's not get into that.
Right.
Not until we do Macbeth.
Nobody says that Macbeth is an ethical character. People like him because he's a compelling character. So let's look at what makes Falstaff a good character.
Okay, well, first off, there's obviously, he is witty, and he has a lot of the good lines.
Yeah, like Shakespeare specifically makes him an incredibly witty character with good comebacks and good metaphors, and I guess they might have been good puns at the time.
Well, if you consider there being such a thing as a good pun.
That's a good point. You can tell that he's educated. He quotes the Bible almost in every scene he's in. Just his individual scenes, especially in Henry IV Part 1, are very amusing.
Yeah.
I mean, when he and the prince role play as the prince and the king, that is a really funny scene to anyone. That entire interaction is great.
Mm-hmm. And at least in Henry IV Part 1, he is definitely a very important character.
Right.
Like, he provides a counterpoint to the king. He provides an alternate father figure for Henry.
Right. And his entire ability to interact with people and win them over makes him a charmer, even to the audience. Like, the fact that all these people can put up with his shenanigans kind of endears you to him. He's just such a active, compelling character in that sense.
Yeah. He comes off as a charming rogue without being charming.
So another thing that I think makes him a compelling character is his complete lack of shame.
Yeah, that is a lot of it. If he felt guilt over anything he did, he'd be a lot less interesting.
Yeah, his just complete bravado. When Hal just comes up to Falstaff and points out one of his shameless lies, Falstaff immediately doesn't back down. He says, "How the world is full of liars," and accuses the prince of being a liar, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he just is always ready with a comeback and is always willing to knock people down, even if they're in positions of power over him.
Yeah, he just... It's odd that for being such a cowardly character, he won't back down in a war of words with anyone.
Yeah, he's always willing to fight on in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
One of his only moments in Merry Wives of Windsor is when, at the beginning, someone's accusing him of all these crimes of robbing people and misleading the youth and stuff like that, and says, "Oh, how would you answer me this?" And Falstaff says, "I will answer it straight. I have done all this. That is now answered." He just blandly confesses to everything because he figures he can avoid prosecution. He's just absolutely shameless.
Yep.
I think the thing that best sums it up, the entire appeal of Falstaff, is when Hal looks down at Falstaff, apparently being dead, and says, "I could have better spared a better man." He's not a good man, mm-hmm. but he's someone that Hal doesn't want to lose because he's such a good person to be around.
He's enjoyable to hang out with.
Yeah.
Sort of.
There is a quote from the Longman Guide to Shakespeare's Characters by Kenneth MacLeish, where he says, What makes Sir John so interesting? How is it, when his actions would repulse many in both a modern and medieval context, we find ourselves so attracted to this lying tub of lard? There are many answers, one no more likely than the next. Most do find some sort of affectionate connection. Possibly his openness in his crimes, his lack of loyalty being so apparent, essentially his frankness, not so much honesty, in life, and his grinning self-determination, self-observance. At best, it can be said that Shakespeare's Falstaff reaches beyond merely making the audience laugh. He is aware that life is a charade, and is markedly responsible for his situation. He besets our hearts, yea, deeper still to our diaphragms. We are his. He has been too great a humorist character to forfeit all good impressions within the length of one play. And you can see the full quote on Wikipedia, the article about Falstaff.
Yep, so now for the negative side of Falstaff.
Yeah, and this, a lot of this is just how he's a bad person.
He's a thief, he's a coward, he's a liar, he's fat and ugly and old.
Yeah. He constantly complains if he's got any sort of problem.
Yep, a whiner. And then his negative side as a character is he just gets so many annoying monologues that are completely irrelevant.
Yeah, we've talked about these in the episodes about Henry IV Part 1 and 2, but some of his monologues are just tedious. Like when he talks about how alcohol is great.
Yep.
I mean, that just goes on for far too long.
Yeah, we all get it. Everyone likes alcohol, but come on.
Yeah, it's just completely bizarre. I mean, it lends some interesting insight into his character, but...
It does?
Well, yeah.
Really?
Well, I think it shows you how he's kind of a devolutionary character, how he brings people down to his level.
Okay.
For example. But there are people who say that although he is all these things, he is not a hypocrite. Which is a bizarre thing to say, as though that justifies all the rest of his flaws.
It's true, he isn't a hypocrite,
though. I would say he also is a hypocrite, because he specifically says things like, oh, I hate cowards, and then he is a coward.
Well, a coward can still hate other cowards.
You can do that, but you can't do it and still be not a hypocrite. Let's just lay to rest whether or not he is a hypocrite, because that isn't a big deal. It's not as though being a guy who runs around robbing people is okay.
And then he gets really upset when someone's robbed him, too. So yeah, I guess he is fairly much a hypocrite.
Yeah, it's completely bizarre. Like, even if he wasn't a hypocrite, he'd still be a bad person. And he also is a hypocrite. It's just a bizarre defense. And this defense is really pioneered by a man named Harold Bloom. You might have heard of him if you're interested in Shakespeare studies. He's probably the biggest fan of Falstaff in all history.
Well, maybe not necessarily that, but...
It might be. In a book he wrote about every single thing Shakespeare's ever done, he gave Falstaff pride of position. Like, more pages about Falstaff than any other character. He says that Hamlet and Falstaff are Shakespeare's two greatest characters, and then he quietly whispers, but not really Hamlet. Because he just devotes so much attention and time to Falstaff and justifying his badness and, like, kind of going back and saying that he's not a bad person. He actually thinks that Prince Hal is a bad person, mainly for turning his back on Falstaff. It's completely bizarre. But the real problem with Harold Bloom is that, one, he doesn't define his terms, and two, he never explains what he's talking about. So maybe I've completely misinterpreted because he's just so obtuse in the way he talks.
I haven't read this, so I have no idea.
Yeah, he's just a bad writer, in addition to being just a completely bizarre fascination with Falstaff. Another person who's been a big fan of Falstaff is Verdi. You probably recognize the name. He's an opera composer.
Mm-hmm.
He made a complete opera, its last opera, about Falstaff, and it's kind of a combination of The Merry Wives of Windsor and his performances in Henry IV Part 1 and 2. It was pretty popular at the time. Obviously, Italian operas today aren't nearly as popular to the common people.
Though you can find versions on DVD.
Yeah. And some other people have written operas about him, including Salieri, and that's it, I guess. It's the only other opera.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got, obviously, Orson Welles, who we've mentioned a few times.
Yeah, he performed Chimes at Midnight in the movie as Falstaff, and then he also had a play just called Falstaff.
Yeah, they were basically the same production, just one was a play and one was a film.
Yeah.
And like we said when we kind of reviewed it, it's a pretty good movie. Obviously, it's an old movie.
Yeah.
It was recorded in the 50s, I believe.
1966.
1966, that was pretty close. But for the time, it's a good movie.
Yes.
Of course, Falstaff has been a favorite of theatrical players as well. We don't know the first person to play Falstaff for Shakespeare, but we know that in 1603, John Lowen joined the troupe to perform him. And since then, the 1600s have seen Falstaff as the most performed character of the entire century. The Lord Admiral's Players, a competing theater troupe to Shakespeare's, made their own plays about Falstaff, known as The Life of Sir John Oldcastle. During the period where the Puritans shut down the theaters, there still were Falstaff performances where they shortened both plays, combined them into a play known as The Bouncing Knight. When the plays returned in 1660, it was an explosion of Falstaff performances. In the late 1600s, there were 6 notable Falstaffs in one generation. A single person would know 6 different actors to play him, almost like our James Bond character, but even more rapidly changing in actors. In the 1700s, it was equally popular, with more than 20 different actors performing the role between 1700 and 1750. The 1800s saw the last of Falstaff's popularity, although the early 1800s witnessed even more performances of Falstaff. After 1852, the character essentially died off in theater. There are some performances of Henry IV, but nothing near the continuous performances that had been from 1660 to 1850. Essentially, 2 centuries of Falstaffs running continuously, something really that few characters have met. Since then, there have been Falstaffs coming and going, but nothing near the popularity that had been seen in the past. Even today, Henry IV can be performed, but it's much less popular than the big tragedies like Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, Macbeth, and so on.
Okay, so that's it for Falstaff. We just thought we'd separate his content from the rest of the stuff so we didn't have to spend so much time during the plays talking about Falstaff. And so we're done with him now.
Hooray! Until we get to Merriweather's Windsor.
Yeah, but like we said, he's not really Falstaff.
Sort of.
So, we do have some news. For the previous episode, I tried a different web host and it didn't go very well, so if you had trouble downloading that, I think we've got it figured out now. When it comes to that sort of thing, please tell us on the blog if you're getting any sort of problems, bardcast.blogspot.com.
Yeah, otherwise we just assume we're getting tons of downloads.
Or something like that. And in fact, if you listen to the podcast at all, please just go to the blog or on iTunes and just say, hey, we listen to the podcast, because we really don't know anything about you guys.
Mm-hmm. Except what countries you're from.
Yeah, we can see when a download comes from a specific country, but that doesn't give us much information. So if you could tell us any of these facts, like why you listen to the podcast, how you heard about the podcast,
what your favorite Shakespeare play is.
Right, if you'd like to hear a specific play, we can accommodate you.
Well, sometimes.
Well, we will.
Eventually.
We'll put it directly on the top of the list, unless there's more requests for something else.
Mm-hmm.
Except we do have an exception right now, because our next episode is going to be about Macbeth.
Or, as some would prefer to call it, the Scottish play.
Right, but we're not superstitious about it, so we call it Macbeth.
Yeah, we will be providing a theater version of it, though, for those of you who are listening to our podcast in a theater, where we'll just bleep out all mentions of the word Macbeth.
That is a lie.
It is not a lie. If you don't do it, I will do it if we get any requests for it.
Okay. Anyway, we saw Macbeth at the Guthrie, and we really enjoyed it, so we're going to do the next episode about that.
Yep.
We've had a couple of requests for Richard III, so after Macbeth, we're planning on doing that, but if we get more requests for something else, we can change.
Yep. Well, after Macbeth, and then whatever intervening podcast we have.
Right. We'll figure it out. We'll obviously figure it out as we go, so We'll keep you updated. So please go to the blog at bardcast.blogspot.com. Please go to iTunes and give us a review. I'm Carson.
And I'm Jeff.
And keep listening.
Please.